Hi, I'm Golden. I'm an intern at Living Waters Church, and today's scripture reading is from Matthew 20, verse 1 to 16. For the kingdom of heaven is like the landowner who went out early one morning to hire workers for his vineyard. He agreed to pay the normal daily wage and send them out to work. At 9 o'clock in the morning, he was passing through the marketplace and saw some people standing around doing nothing, so he hired them, telling them he would pay them whatever was right at the end of the day. So they went to work in the vineyard. At noon and again at 3 o'clock, he did the same thing. At 5 o'clock that afternoon, he was in town again and saw more people standing around. He asked them, "Why haven't you been working today?" They replied, "Because no one hired us." The landowner told them, "Then go out and join the others in my vineyard." That evening, he told the foreman to call the workers in and pay them, beginning with the last workers first. When those hired at 5 o'clock were paid, each received a full day's wage. When those hired first came to get their pay, they assumed they would receive more, but they too were paid a day's wage. When they received their pay, they protested to the owner, "Those people worked only 1 hour, and yet you've paid them just as much as you paid us who worked all day in the scorching heat." He answered one of them, "Friend, I haven't been unfair. Didn't you agree to work all day for the usual wage? Take your money and go. I wanted to pay this last worker the same as you. Is it against the law for me to do what I want with my money? Should you be jealous because I am kind to others? So those who are last now will be the first, and those who are first will be last."
Hi, everybody. Good to be with you. My name is Luke. I'm on our pastoral team, and we're continuing today in our Essentials series, which is a series about a Christian worldview. It's a chance to deepen and to reflect on what we really mean by being a Christian. I love what Dave shared last week about our Essentials series. He said, through this series and this time, even connected to Lent, as we approach Easter, this is a strange season in which we could easily plateau. But our intention through this series is not to plateau in our faith, but is actually to grow in our faith. And so as we learn and as we reflect and deepen, as we talk about these Christian worldviews and what it means to be a deep person of faith, we hope that we experience growth together. So far in our Essential series, we've talked about creation for 2 weeks. The last 2 weeks, we talked about Jesus. And this week, we're going to talk about grace, and next week as well. I'll share this week, and then Kirsten will share next week. She'll clean up any of the mess that I'm going to make this week for us. So grace. The story that we just heard of the workers in the vineyard from Matthew chapter 20 reminds me actually of a play that I saw a number of years ago called Jesus Hopped the A-Train. It's set in Rikers Prison, and it surrounds a couple of characters who've been locked up for murder. It was a very uncomfortable play, not only because it was filled with all kinds of colorful language that you would expect to hear in a prison, but also because it asked the audience seriously difficult questions about grace. One of the characters, named Angel, interestingly, is serving time for murder. But it's the kind of murder that some people might describe as justifiable, at the very least complex. Angel, however, doesn't really believe that he belongs in prison. And he certainly doesn't believe that he belongs in the same company of the people that he sees around him, people that he defines as real criminals, you might say. One of those people is Lucius. Lucius is a serial killer, but in a turn of events in prison, he's actually become a born-again Christian. And it's clear that Lucius, even though he's experienced this conversion, is still fighting with his own demons. Lucius routinely scrambles angels' equations of grace. Surely, angel wonders, surely I'm different from him. The opening scene, actually, of the play is of Angel on his knees, and he's in prayer during his first night in prison, and he's terrified. He tries to put together the Lord's Prayer from distant memory, but he struggles. He prays, "Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name." So you start out feeling that Angel has a lot to learn about the God he misnames and about grace. But as the story unfolds, you realize that you also have a lot to learn as an audience member. The play goes around and around. It asks deeper and deeper questions. And just when you think that you're comfortable, just when you think that you've got grace figured out or pinned down, something happens making you uncomfortable again, asking you more questions about how grace works, who should get grace, and who shouldn't. I remember driving home with a friend after watching the play and feeling very convicted and conflicted, really, about what we'd just seen. The story made us think about the true depth of grace, challenging our assumptions and our judgments. And I think that was the point and why it's a very good play. So the story of the workers in the vineyard does that same kind of thing by challenging our assumptions and our judgments. Jesus often tells parables to get a main point across, and many times his stories make his listeners uncomfortable. A parable, just to be clear, is not so much an allegory, which is something that's a kind of story which has each part representing something else. Instead, a parable is more just like a picture that Jesus uses to get something across, a main point really across about God's character and kingdom. And what's coming across through this story about the benevolent vineyard owner is that God isn't all that bothered with our pecking orders or various constructs of fairness in the world. For the first listeners, many of whom were law-abiding Israelites, this story said that God was opening the door of blessing to non-Israelites, even though these outsiders hadn't been committed to God in the past. And according to Jesus, they'd better get used to it, because the kingdom that he spoke about was breaking in around them as he spoke. Is it against the law for me to do what I want with my money? Should you be jealous that I'm being kind to others? And that's what we hear the vineyard owner ask the grumbling workers. And that's really Jesus' main thrust. God can do what God likes. And who are we to tell him that he's being too kind or too welcoming to people that we might label undeserving? So here is Jesus turning up with God's hope and welcome, not just for the straight-laced Israelite who are doing things the right way, but for people who have done things the wrong way. As you'd expect, these kinds of stories ruffled some feathers, as they still ruffle feathers today. How dare God be so unfair? You get the sense in this story that if we think that we can control God's impulse to love, or that we can systematize or manage grace according to our equations, then we're going to get very frustrated with God very quickly. It's not dissimilar to what we hear Jesus say, actually, in Matthew chapter 5. "The rain falls on the just and the unjust alike," says Jesus. Good luck trying to organize and control the rain. Trying to stop God from being gracious is like trying to stop the rain from being wet. So God's welcome and grace has nothing to do with whether or not you put your back into it, so to speak. Grace is rooted in God's capacity to love, not my capacity to work, which is why it affects our ideas of how grace should work. It's not necessarily based on us, it's based on God. But what the story also does, beyond that big idea, and through the interaction that we hear between the vineyard owner and the workers, is to confront us with some of our obsessive illusions, we could say, about God and how we think the world should work. So what are some of the obsessions that we carry that come through to us, maybe, in this story? The first obsession is quite obvious. It has to do with effort. At the end of the workday, we hear, when those hired first came to get their pay, they assumed that they would receive more, but they too were paid a day's wage. So, even though the workers had received a full day's wage, those hired first assumed that the vineyard was run according to how much effort they'd given. What they had forgotten, of course, was that they wouldn't have had any work in the vineyard in the first place if the owner hadn't hired them. Everything that they had thought they had earned was really still dependent on the benevolence of the one who owned the vineyard and gave them work. When thinking about grace, that's a very important obsession and assumption to point out. Our world is obsessed with merit. We carry the assumption that we are worth more or deserve more based on the effort that we exert or the time that we invest. And so we walk around with thoughts like, I've done enough, or I've not done enough, to merit this or to merit that. And we apply this across every relationship that we have, including our relationship with God. And though these assumptions are pliable in the world's economies and social constructs, they simply don't fit with God's kingdom and God's character. And this is what the Apostle Paul holds up over and over again, and what we see most brilliantly in his letter to the Ephesians. God saved you by his grace when you believed, and you can't take credit for this. It's a gift from God. Salvation is not a reward for the good things we have done, so none of us can boast about it. But it's very easy, isn't it, to apply our constructs of merit, effort, or earning to God, and how God surely must relate to us, and then maybe even how we must relate to others. It can be mind-bending to learn how to relate to a being who is so unlike anyone else we know, and who sets terms that we're completely unfamiliar with. God's love, God's welcome and gift of life itself, isn't contingent on, as I said earlier, how much I put my back into it. We are just given to by God. Learning to be a receiver rather than an earner is much of what Christian maturity feels like. And that isn't to say that work doesn't come with faith. We read a lot about that in different places, like the book of James in the New Testament, for example. But it is just to say that in the end, all things considered, what I get from God is always rooted in God's life and action, not in mine. And that all that is asked of me is just to open my hands and accept. Connected to the obsession about effort or earning is the obsession of fairness. We become so sure that we should be dealt with based on our efforts that we begin to look around and wonder about what's fair and what's not fair. We think, well, they've done this or they haven't done that. Therefore, they should get this result or that result. Of course, the underlying problem here is is that fairness often appears to be objective, when in fact it's very subjective. Which is why many wise old saints have often said that we should be grateful that God relates to us based on his goodness, not on our subjective concepts of fairness, subjective and deceptive, might I add. If we want to be related to based on fairness, then most of us would be in a pickle. Arguing that I'm no worse than the next person depends very much on who the next person might be. Do we really want to live in a world of fairness, or do we want to live in a world that's grounded in grace and goodness? So the obsession about effort leads to an obsession about fairness, which inevitably leads to the obsession with comparison or competition. And that's where this story ends up. The workers hired first compare themselves to those hired last, and things get competitive. I worked 8 hours. Why are they being paid the same as me for only working 1 hour? But you have to really wonder if those hired first would mind so much about fairness and a competitive rate if the shoe was on the other foot. You know, comparison and competition works when we're winning, whatever that means, but it gets pretty inconvenient and devastating when we're not, in some comfortable position of advantage. But our positions of advantage mean little to God when it comes to grace. Of course, this is why the gospel can be so offensive to the people who have, and a relief to the people who don't have. The kingdom of Jesus, the kingdom that he imagines, does not divide people into winners and losers, does not divide people into first and last, as we heard. Jesus points us away from us and them thinking, towards the truth that we're all simply under God's one roof. That reality of being under God's roof was hard to see then, and it's still hard to see now. For example, you get the sense in this story that the workers hired first might have some anxiety about whether or not there's enough to go around, which is why that incisive response from the vineyard owner hits so hard. What difference does it make to you how I choose to treat another and how I choose to spend my money? Is there some anxiety bubbling up amongst those hired first that someone has to lose in order for them to win? That someone has to be left out in order for them to be fully welcomed? Well, that's often the world that we live in, isn't it? Without reading too much into the story, it does draw out these fears we have about scarcity, which the first listeners must have felt keenly under the oppressive thumb of the Roman Empire. But of course, Jesus points us away from that and towards God's goodness and abundance, demonstrating that this growing kingdom of grace is renewing a world that's scarred by sin and scarcity. It's one of the reasons I think that Jesus is always multiplying food. Food always spells grace out for us, doesn't it? And it's why the church must always remember food, and food is central to the life of the church. It's also why the church needs to always actively fight poverty, scarcity, and resource hoarding where we can. As the hands and feet of Jesus, we must always be about multiplying work. Multiplying speaks of the abundance of God, especially in service of those who are going without, no matter where they live or what they believe, which is why it's so encouraging that we can continue to participate in events like the coldest night of the year in service of Langley's homeless shelter, the Gateway of Hope. So those are some of the obsessions that appear as we look through this story. And if we're honest, as we look inward at ourselves, we can be obsessed with effort, with fairness, with comparison or competition. And those obsessions can make for a pretty dismal view and experience of life. As we look around us, those obsessions make for a pretty dismal world to live in. It's a world that ends up looking like burden piling, of dog eat dog, of point scoring, and scarcity. Thankfully, Jesus has disrupted those obsessions and equations by putting God's generosity on full display through his own outrageous life. He dismantles these unhealthy and unsustainable obsessions that we carry about how we relate to God and then how we relate to each other. Jesus' life says that the world does not turn on my action. The world turns on God's action. Human value is not measured on a subjective and sliding scale of fairness or comparison. You don't have to compete with others for love, for grace, for welcome when it comes to God. We may have needed to fight for scraps at the dining table, fighting off our brothers and sisters for the last potato, but you don't have to worry about that. With God, there's enough to go around. And so grace is rooted in God's generous character, not the economies of effort, of competition, or fairness. That character was put on full display with Jesus and his crucifixion. The vision of Jesus on a cross says that God doesn't hold anything back from us. He'll give you everything in abundance. And if you don't believe that, just look at Jesus dying on the cross from exposure and asphyxiation. The generosity and the self-giving love of Jesus is outrageous, and it's why stories like these still draw a reaction. Listen to him, however, and we find ourselves growing, learning to trust that God is outrageously gracious begins to seep in after a while. Spend enough time in the vineyard, and before long, you'll start living and thinking like the vineyard owner. A life of faith, then, is about getting to know Jesus, where we slowly become more and more convinced that God is gracious and that we can be too. We get free from our obsessions of fairness and competition and effort and begin to live not out of scarcity, but out of abundance, drawing on God's capacity, not our own. The story, as I was reading through it, did bring to mind for me where we're at globally when it comes to resource distribution at the moment. Are we comfortable hearing that some lives are being considered less valuable than others, particularly lives in vulnerable positions? Recently, I saw reports of vaccines being delivered to prisons, and there was seeming to be a lot of anger that was being poured out by some people, which was alarming. In effect, some were saying, listen, the first should be first, and the last are last for a reason. Well, God help us if that's our reaction as Christians. Is this not a time to recommit ourselves to the kingdom of heaven and this vision of abundance and generosity rather than scarcity and hoarding? How can we pray and act as Christians to ensure the gracious voice of Jesus is heard in our time, in our church, in our neighborhoods? Grace makes room, and we become very good conduits of grace when we make room. It's why we're having more discussions about equality and equity within our church. We're trying to make room for more voices that have historically been tuned out. And learning to make room doesn't mean that there is less room at the table for me. That's not the gospel. Someone else receiving doesn't mean that I'm being robbed. In fact, it seems the opposite is true in Jesus' kingdom. Welcome tends to compound and multiply, which is very good news. You know, like other parables, this story is meant to shock us. It's meant to offend our sensibilities about how God really works. And reading this story, we might even find ourselves saying, you know, I think those complainers had a point, didn't they? But maybe that only betrays in us this deeper need for a greater familiarity with grace ourselves, and really how far off we can be sometimes from the kingdom of heaven. It reminds me, when I read stories like this, of how much I desperately need Jesus, and that I still have a lot to learn, that grace is rooted in God's capacity, not in my capacity. Some days, I do feel an awful lot like that character in Jesus Hopped the A-Train. That character named Angel is not only locked up in Riker's prison, but also imprisoned by his own judgment and scarcity. Like Angel, I'm in desperate need of this increasing freedom that grace can bring me. And when I acknowledge that need, when I stand out in the pouring rain and let rain do what rain does, I begin to see the world no longer as a desert or as a prison, but as a garden that's bursting with potential. Bless you.